morning, and may it please the court. My name is Paul Barnett. I'm an assistant attorney general with the Wisconsin Department of Justice, appearing on behalf of the state of Wisconsin appellant in this admiralty proceeding. Admiralty is an equitable proceeding. In this case, the equities either favor Wisconsin or disfavor Mr. Ehorn. Substantial justice demands reversal to permit Wisconsin to proceed in this action based on its answer and amended claim. Defaulting Wisconsin out, which is essentially what the district court did, is an excessive sanction under the circumstances. Wisconsin's amended claim and answer are not untimely.
We're talking about equity here. Wisconsin did nothing for 70 years while the ship sat on the bottom of Lake Michigan.
That's not correct, Your Honor. The record reflects, among other things, the testimony of the State Historical Society representative Jeff Gray, which is attached to my affidavit at Record 31. This was Mr. Gray's testimony at the criminal preliminary proceeding in the prosecution of Mr. Ehorn for looting the Rosinco. Mr. Gray testified that the Rosinco is of historic and archaeological interest.
What did Wisconsin ever do prior to all this hubbub about him looting the ship and then going into Admiralty Court? What did Wisconsin ever do to assert any right to this ship? Seeing that you started off talking about the equity.
Wisconsin listed the Rosinco in the Historical Society list of archaeological sites. The wreck also appears on the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resource Shipwrecks database. In addition, as Judge Evans, you've already alluded to, Wisconsin manifested its interest in the shipwreck by exercising core sovereign powers of arrest and prosecution of Mr. Ehorn for looting the shipwreck. And throughout the course of those proceedings, consistently and repeatedly maintained its interest in the wreck.
How would a seizure of property from the wreck better achieve the goals of the arrest warrant? How would this have given Wisconsin better notice?
Well, first, two responses. First, the purpose of a seizure, the execution of process, is not only to provide notice to those interested persons so that they may protect their interests, but it is also to perfect the district court's dominion and control, i.e., its jurisdiction over the wreck. Second, well established in case law, as an alternative to the actual seizure of the wreck, is execution of the arrest warrant by service of the arrest warrant upon a custodian of artifacts of the Rosinco. The artifacts which Mr. Ehorn looted from the vessel are in the possession of Wisconsin law enforcement officers. Mr. Ehorn knows that. He knew it at the time he filed this admiralty proceeding, and yet he failed to inform the district court of that fact. Had the district court been informed of that fact, the arrest warrant under prevailing case law could have been executed by service of the warrant on Wisconsin representatives, and that, Judge Rovner, would have provided a direct notice to Wisconsin authorities of the pendency of the admiralty proceeding and enabled Wisconsin at that early juncture to have defended its interest in the Rosinco.
Well, you know, you argued in the reply brief that if the complaint had been served, Wisconsin would have timely answered. But you found out about the complaint before the time the answer expired, neither answered nor requested an extension of time. And that seems, you know, inconsistent to me, considering your whole argument here.
No, let me explain, Judge Rovner. Mr. Lee, who submitted the affidavit explaining why an answer was not timely filed, explained that his understanding was that an answer would be due if and when the Admiralty complaint were actually served upon a authorized representative of the state of Wisconsin, including its State Historical Society. At that point, given Mr. Lee's understanding of when an answer would be due, an answer would have been filed within 20 days following personal service of the Admiralty complaint upon Wisconsin's authorized representatives. So what I am saying is that application of Mr. Lee's understanding of when an answer would have been due would have resulted in the filing of an answer timely, because Mr. Lee's understanding was premised upon personal service of the complaint. And so, Judge Rovner, had the complaint been personally served on Wisconsin, applying Mr. Lee's understanding of the applicable procedure, an answer would have been timely.
What kind of a Pandora's box do you think we would open up if we depended on a particular attorney's understanding of law, which turns out to be completely inconsistent with the law as it is? Where would we be?
Well, I submit that the court would end up no differently than it did end up in the Alter Barge case, where because of attorney error, an injured worker's claim was not filed for several months after the deadline.
Now, of course, you didn't inform the court in your opening brief that the holding in Alter Barge was expressly limited to the facts of that case.
We did indicate that in our reply brief, Judge Rovner, and we believe
it was called to your attention.
No, we believe the operative facts are that the claimant in that case initiated a legal action against the Admiralty plaintiff. The claimant then subsequently missed the deadline to, in that case, file the claim in the subsequently brought Admiralty action. A motion for leave to file was submitted 84 days after that deadline passed, and the trial court denied that motion on the grounds that the claimant failed to show good cause. We believe that those facts, in coalition with each other, are analogous to the facts presented here. Whereas the claimant in Alter Barge was seeking money damages for his injuries, here we have an irreplaceable historic resource that is, as I indicated earlier, being managed and protected by Wisconsin. The execution of the arrest warrant, a necessary condition to perfecting the district court's authority over the vessel, did not occur, and therefore, by operation of Supplemental Rule C-6, the version that was in effect at the time this action was brought, no claim and no answer are yet due because of the incomplete or unexecuted arrest warrant. the district court below abused its discretion in refusing to allow Wisconsin to proceed on the amended claim and the answer, with under the this court's authority, $103,387.27. The three factors the district, this court held were relevant. All favor Wisconsin here. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Barnett. Mr. Haywood.
Good morning, judges. I'm David Haywood. I represent the appellee here, Mr. Paul Ehorn. I would suggest to the court that the real issue before the court here, while there are substantial side issues, is whether the state of Wisconsin can, in fact, ignore the rules and delay their filing of an answer.
Let me tell you what bothers me here. This seems a little maybe sneaky or something, that this admiralty action is filed after all these proceedings are going on in a criminal in charge in Kenosha, where the state is claiming ownership in that case, and the state actually had a preliminary hearing, bound over for trial on a felony charge, and no personal notice is given to the state, and none of that is disclosed when you go into federal court to proceed in admiralty. It's like the ship has just been out here, just discovered, and we're trying to determine ownership. Why wouldn't it seems to me that the right thing would have been to disclose that there have been lengthy criminal proceedings, and now we're going to claim ownership or try to establish that we have ownership interest superior to the state of Wisconsin.
Your Honor, at the time, first off, let me indicate Mr. Ehorn was not looting that wreck. He salvaged one item for the purposes of establishing
his
claim.
It is a little overstatement by the state, but he apparently made 100 dives or something down here.
He had located this wreck a number of years ago and had made many dives on the wreck. If he wanted to loot it, he could have done it long before this point in time. And in fact, Your Honor, we have been through this process before. The fact of the matter is that if one looks at...
So why don't you address Judge Evans's question?
It
concerns me, too.
Okay.
This looks like game playing. Your client files an admiralty libel and does not give the state actual notice, although he surely knows that the state is the competing claimant. And then you or somebody else representing him, the day after he thinks the time has run out, calls and says, ha ha, gotcha, your time has expired. This looks like game playing to me.
I understand. The fact of the matter is not as you suggest. In fact,
what fact have we misunderstood? Was actual notice given to the state of Wisconsin?
The state of Wisconsin was told well in advance of our filing. And in fact,
was actual notice, counsel, was actual notice of the filing given to the state of Wisconsin? And if so, how and when?
If the court is asking were they served with the complaint, the answer is no.
I thought that the first notice was, as Judge Easterbrook said, when the call was made to the district attorney in Kenosha saying, the deadline has passed and you didn't file a claim. So that's the first time anybody in Kenosha and the state had actual notice of what was going on in the federal building in Milwaukee.
No, I don't think that's true.
Okay, so give us the details of how and when actual notice was given at an earlier time.
Actual notice, at least oral notice, was given, and in fact it's documented in the judge's notes, which are before this court, back in July. that this claim was to be filed.
No. Telling somebody orally, we're going to file a claim, is not the same as telling them we have filed a claim. Telling them we have filed a claim starts clocks running.
I understand.
You can't say, I'm going to file a civil suit, and then file the civil suit in the dead of night and not give notice to the opposing party, and then say, ooh, your time to file a response has run. Right? It won't do to say, yeah, but we told them 2 months earlier that we would file a lawsuit.
I understand, but this was not filed in the dead of night. It was published in two newspapers. You know,
the Supreme Court posted. Generally treats notice by newspaper as the equivalent of no notice. You use newspaper publication when you don't know and can't otherwise find out who would have a claim. The Supreme Court has said that using newspaper publication when you know the identity of the adverse claimant is not sufficient under the Due Process Clause. Your client knew the identity of the adverse claimant, QED.
And we felt that we had certainly alerted them to the fact that we were going to assert our claim of ownership. The answer, did we file the complaint? Did we serve them with the complaint? The answer is no. But this is not a situation where people were operating in a vacuum. Yes, ma'am.
I have another question, and it involves the 103,000 currency case, because, of course, that's a Tenth Circuit case, and the district court relied on the factors that were set out in that particular case. And the Tenth Circuit lists a number of factors that aren't part of our test in the $103,000 case. Isn't that a per se abuse of discretion to rely on a case from another circuit when we, the Seventh Circuit, have already set out a different analysis?
Are you asking whether or not to use another circuit's case as somewhat improper with regard to cases within this circuit? I'm not sure that I agree that it is, Your Honor. The circuit court's cases are certainly published cases, and they're cases that apply across the land, so to speak. So I don't think it's improper to use the case of another circuit. No.
Even though we've set out a different analysis in this circuit? That's the problem here. Of course, we rely on other circuits constantly, but not when the law of another circuit diverges from our circuit. That's really my question.
Well, Your Honor, I believe the 103,000 case is, in fact, the Seventh Circuit. I'm not sure I understand what case you're suggesting that we used improperly.
The Tenth Circuit case that you used. Go on with your argument while I search.
Let me ask you another question while Judge Roger is searching for that one. This claim was unverified, but it was still a couple of page document that the Kenosha DA filed after your call saying time is up. And they said, oh, I think we have a few more days. They filed this claim. What is in that claim that could not also be construed as an answer? The state claimed ownership in that claim.
Yes, Your Honor, I don't think it can be.
It's an equitable proceeding where you want to find out who really is the owner.
I don't believe it can be considered an answer because it doesn't address the claims of the plaintiff here to the extent that it makes an additional claim, but that claim is based upon the state statute. And, you know, I suggest to the court there have been two cases out of this particular circuit which addresses the whole question of the ASA and whether or not the ASA supersedes the state's legislation.
Right. You tell me what the state was supposed to do at that time. file a claim, go down to the federal court and get a copy of the complaint because they had not personally been served with it. Is that correct?
If they wanted to file an answer?
Right.
Well, the fact of the matter is they did file a claim. They did file a claim, and they filed it timely.
Right.
So, you know, in all reality, they obviously had notice.
What were they supposed to do after that little three-page claim was filed before or on November 3rd? What were they supposed to do?
Your Honor, according to the rules, they have to file an answer.
Well, what are they? How do they get the complaint to know how to answer it?
Well, I don't think that's too difficult.
Tell me how they do it.
A simple way of getting it between counsel is to call up and say, can I have it? So certainly they could have done that. It's an item of record, as a matter of fact, so they certainly could have acquired it from the court. It's not something that is that difficult to acquire. And in fact, if you look at the record, Your Honor, there were three different attorneys involved in the course of that particular time. That's why I say all of this wasn't done in a vacuum. Communication with these attorneys?
It wasn't done in a vacuum. The background of it was that there was a criminal case where the state was alleging ownership of the vessel.
Under state law. Totally ignoring the effect and the application of the Abandoned Shipwreck Act. Now, if the state claimed ownership, there are things they had to do. They had to establish that this wreck was either embedded, which in the Great Lakes, typically the wrecks are not embedded. If they're in any depth of water at all, they typically lay on the bottom, fully exposed, and generally quite intact. So they could have either established that it was embedded, which they can't in this particular case, or, as was suggested by His Honor, they've had many, many years since the passage of the ASA to establish the eligibility.
Well, I mean, I mentioned earlier that there's not a lot of room for sympathy for the state because the ship had been underwater for 75 years and that law, the federal law, had been on the books for a dozen years. The state really hasn't done anything.
That is correct.
Serpent of Paracletus. I'm never going to do shorthand again. What's the case? Go ahead.
Okay. Wisconsin suggests that the standard of substantial justice is the one that has to be applied here, to the extent that they allege that Judge Callahan certainly did not result in substantial justice. I think the question that has the appellee here, the question that we would pose is whether or not substantial justice does not apply to, in fact, all parties, or does it only apply to the state of Wisconsin? We also assert, as we have in our brief, that this court certainly didn't intend that a new standard of substantial justice would apply in all admiralty cases. And in fact, in that case, it was quite clearly limited to the facts of that case. The Alter Barge case can certainly be distinguished between this case as well, to the extent that the initial claim in that case was...
Let me ask a somewhat different version of Judge Evans's question. Could you articulate the prejudice your client suffered from the delay in filing a formal answer compared to the information that was in the claim? What information was it that would have been in the answer and was not in the claim itself which caused some prejudice in this litigation?
The prejudice would result from the determination of eligibility, Your Honor. In the answer that was eventually filed, as you're probably aware, it was filed one day after receiving the determination of eligibility. Now, this particular document had never been sought before, had never been issued before, and it's not sought until several months after the claim.
Why is this related to delay in filing the answer? Presumably this document would have had the same legal effect whether it occurred before or after the answer.
Well, I'm not the one, Your Honor, who decided to delay my filing, but it seems rather clear to us that there was a strategic reason there for delaying the filing by the state.
What was the reason? What legal effect did it make, whether this occurred before or after the answer?
The legal effect is that the state had no valid claim to the Rusinko prior to securing the determination of eligibility. And at the time of the filing of the plaintiff's claim, there was no way that the state could claim its ownership. The state just did not own it. It was not embedded. It was not listed. And by allowing the state to, in effect, bootstrap itself to a situation which, in all reality, eliminates the claim of the plaintiff and a valid claim at the time it was made.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the prejudice, I believe.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Anything further, Mr. Barnett?
Yes.
Suppose Wisconsin had filed a timely answer following the claim it filed, and then subsequently obtained the determination of eligibility, and pursuant to Rule 15 of the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure, sought leave to amend its answer to incorporate that development. I submit that the status of this case would be in no material way different than as it actually developed in the district court. The only thing missing was a timely answer. The absence of a timely answer has been explained, and to the extent there's any doubt, Wisconsin and I personally flatly reject the assertion in Mr. Ehorn's briefs that there was a deliberate decision not to file an answer for the reasons hypothesized in those briefs. There are 700 plus shipwrecks on the Wisconsin side of Lake Michigan. Wisconsin has successfully registered a couple of dozen of those shipwrecks, and I am informed is the leading such registrar among the 50 states. While if Wisconsin had unlimited resources and could predict when divers would access ships and damage them by removing artifacts rather than maintaining their integrity, Wisconsin could well perhaps have proceeded to obtain the required determination of eligibility for all of those ships.
Why doesn't Wisconsin just hire this guy to go out and get the things out of the ship and then split it or something? What good does it do the state of Wisconsin? And
Wisconsin's interest in the vessel is as a historic relic. In the record is the submission, the application for the determination of eligibility, which goes into great detail regarding the specific historic significance of this vessel. Wisconsin is not interested in selling the ship or in any way dividing the proceeds or the contents of the vessel. Wisconsin's interest is as a preserver of the history of its citizens, for the benefit of its citizens, to make this history equally available to all who would enjoy accessing it. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, counsel. The case will be taken under advisement.
We'll hear argument now in the case of Whiting against Westray.